Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. Lately, there's been a series of news stories, you may have seen some, about a mysterious computer worm attacking nuclear processing facilities in Iran and some other stories following on to that, and speculation about who launched these cyber attacks. Is it cyber warfare on the part of Israel and or the U.S.? In any event, these worms now seem to be spreading, which is even more worrisome. So this is the topic of our show today, cyber warfare and its possible impacts on the security of government and industrial facilities around the world, and even our own personal computers and computer-based devices, potentially. So my guest today is Dr. Richard Ford, who is the director of the Harris Institute for Assured Information at the Florida Institute of Technology in Melbourne, Florida. Richard's an expert in cybersecurity. This new battleground is not just in personal computing, but in corporate and even national security, as I said. Welcome, Richard.
Well, thank you for having me on, Court. It's a pleasure to be here.
And as you hear from his accent, he's British and I guess is a physicist with a doctorate in semiconductor physics from the Queen's College in Oxford, and used to be in industry at IBM and a corporate chief technology officer, but he's now the director of the center I mentioned at FIT and a professor of computer sciences there. So just briefly, Richard, what does your center do?
So the center, the Harris Institute, represents a place that companies and academics can get together to look at real-world problems. It also provides a fantastic way for our students to get plugged in and understand more about the problems of computer security in corporations and within the Defense Department. So it's a place where these different people and different stakeholders can get together and look at difficult problems. One of the things I like most about it is that we try and be pretty interdisciplinary, so we're not even all just computer scientists. We have biologists and psych people sitting around too, which makes it interesting.
Yeah, so it really is a good institute focused on these problems, which is a reason I wanted to talk with you about cyber warfare. But first, let's do a quick tutorial, if you can, on the types of computer security threats. I think you call them malware as a general term.
Right. So malware has been around for almost as long as we've had personal computers. In fact, arguably longer than we've had personal computers. When we all first started using PCs, what we would hear about mostly was computer viruses. And you would get viruses off diskettes that you shared with your friends, and you know they would maybe put a bouncing ball on your screen or do something irritating like make everything run away from your cursor while you moved it around the screen. I recall the Cascade virus would randomly have all the letters on your little green screen drop to the bottom of the screen. They weren't terribly destructive. They were more pranks than anything else.
Yeah.
But more recently, we've seen attacks that are much more interesting. So viruses are fun because they self-replicate. That means they know how to copy themselves and they spread. They use a user to help them spread. But once we started wiring up all our computers to the internet, another two types of threat became much more common, and that's Trojan horses and worms. Worms, probably the most common one that people remember would be SQL Slammer, going back several years now. It was a tiny little worm, just a few hundred bytes in length, and it spread all around the world in about 10 minutes. And what it did was simply replicate. Worms don't need people to help them replicate. They just hop from computer to computer, and they tend to spread very widely. But I say tend to because some of the threats we'll be talking about today are also worms, and they're much more targeted. Then there's Trojan horses, and the Trojan horse encompasses a bunch of different things, but the bottom line is the Trojan horses, it looks like something that you want. It looks like something that's benign, and it turns out to be something that's not going to work out very well for you at all. And within Trojan horses, often you see things like spyware and adware. Of course, spyware monitors your computer in some way, and then there's adware, which just displays annoying ads wherever you go.
Yeah.
Those are the sort of big threats to home computer users and companies, really. I'd say endpoint security.
So, you know, there are hacking attacks and phishing attacks. I mean, are those encompassed within what you just described?
No, those are a good addition, actually. What I was thinking about as I responded to you was more software-based attacks.
Oh, okay.
A phishing attack is where, of course, I send you an email and say, Court, your eBay account's about to expire. You need to type your username and password here. And, of course, unbelievably, people actually fall for that. and they will fill that stuff out and dutifully send it back, or click on a link that takes them to somewhere bad.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, a hacking attack is where a person actually targets your computer, and you're kind of in the crosshairs, so it's much more sort of personal and direct, and that would be driven by a person. All the other things I listed earlier were basically software-based attacks on computers.
All right. So, I mean, the latter things we've been talking about are identity theft, really, or routes to it. But we kind of all generally know, hopefully now, about personal computer security and the possibility of identity theft. But what we really want to talk about in this show then more, that's kind of a lead-in to the bigger issue that's more emerging now of national security and both government assets and commercial infrastructure, like the power system and the banking system and things like that can be threatened. There's even a U.S. cybersecurity czar. I don't know that too many people know about that yet, but it's fairly recent. So, you know, let's talk about that. I mean, this issue first emerged back in 2010 with a worm called Stuxnet. What was that about?
Well, I would say the issue goes back even further than that, but I think it hit the public eye when Stuxnet started doing the rounds.
Okay.
But within the industry, we've been talking about and worrying about these kind of attacks for a very long time. So I think, you know, you're very timely, and yes, Stuxnet was the first sort of public shot that we saw that was very visible. But in fact, these kind of threats and attacks have been going on for years and years and years. Stuxnet's notable, though, because again, it got picked up by the major media, and it was probably the most impressive thing that we'd seen at the time. It was, let me think, summer of 2010, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
And the cool thing about Stuxnet is it was loosely self-replicating, so it was a worm. It spread, but it didn't spread very far. And it absolutely, it was a very large piece of malware, very, very complex. Some people have said it's the most complex piece of malware that we'd seen at the time. And it seemed to be targeting Iran, among other places, but it was sort of that part of the world. And it had a bunch of modules in it that could do different things. One of them, of course, was to go after something called a SCADA system developed by Siemens. And that's interesting because it takes a cyber threat and moves it into the real world, the physical world.
And my recollection was that it was aimed not just at Iran generally, but at its nuclear processing facilities to try to break the equipment, right?
Well, that's the belief, yes. Of course, coming down with really hard facts on these things is a little bit tricky. But our belief is, and that's what most of the reports would tell you, is that it was really going after the nuclear facilities, in particular the centrifuges that we used to help refine the uranium. Of course, a lot of this stuff gets a little bit sketchy, so it comes down to opinion. We don't know what some of the SCADA code exactly did. There's a lot to analyze, but that's actually a pretty good statement. Yeah, that's really what the target seems to be.
I think I recall that Iran eventually, although at first denying it, I think they eventually admitted that there was some damage done to some percentage of their centrifuges. So if that's the case, it was, as I understand it, the first really true cyber weapon to actually do physical damage to a target. Is that accurate or just still speculative?
No, I think Iran did come out with a few statements that blamed their lack of progress on Stuxnet. Of course, again, information that you receive like that, you always have to treat with a small grain of salt. It's a good reason for also saying why you're not being successful doing what you were doing, right?
Yeah, that's right.
So you have to do that kind of analysis, but it seems like a lightly true statement. I'm trying to think if it's the first cyber weapon, arguably, and I think it's not, but the other ones, again, just didn't get anything like as much publicity. We've seen distributed denial-of-service attacks carried out on countries before.
You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with Dr. Richard Ford, who's the director of the Harris Institute for Assured Information at the Florida Institute of Technology. He's an expert on cybersecurity and cyber warfare, and that's what we're talking about, is kind of recent indications that some countries have developed cyber weapons that they're using to target enemy nations' facilities. And so I think we really want to kind of focus a little later on in the show on what that means in terms of potential blowback toward us and toward the civilian computer security system. So I think kind of the next step that I'm aware of, and again, Richard, a lot of these things may go on behind the scenes and unknown to the mainstream media, but in late 2011, a new Trojan horse called Dooku, D-U-Q-U. I'm not sure I'm pronouncing it right, but that's probably close enough. Anyway, this Duku Trojan horse was detected that I gather shares a lot of the same code as Stuxnet, but that does something different. What does it do?
Right, so Duku is a worm, and yes, analysis would say that it contains similar code to Stuxnet. Of course, these things get distributed in binary form, so we don't actually get to read their source code, but we can look at similarities between the binaries and say, yes, this really looks like it was written in such and such a language and is a close relative of Stuxnet. Duku is pretty modular, so it was built to be extended. And that's the other thing to remember when you look at these weapons, and I think that's probably the right word for it, is that they contain modules, and you can kind of install or remove modules as you see fit. So you can take the basic Duku infrastructure and have it do something else for you by turning on a new module. So it's extremely modular, built to be extendable, primarily interested itself in information gathering. So in other words, it was looking for things that could be useful for another attack. It didn't really do anything destructive, but it was gathering information. So it was like a reconnaissance tool, if you like.
Yeah, I've seen it called a surveillance worm, which probably is a new term in your field, huh?
Yes, it is. I mean, we love making up new terms.
Everybody does.
That's why they pay us the big bucks.
There you go.
If we use simple words, it sounds far too pedestrian.
It's like anybody could do it, even some kid in a basement in Romania, for example, or whatever, right? So, I mean, you know, I think as you suggested, the information that this steals potentially could be used to develop new cyber weapons that would disrupt, I guess, computers controlling power plants and oil refineries and other critical infrastructure networks anywhere. So that begins to be the scary part of our show, right?
Yes. I think it was McAfee which was looking at Duku, and one of their conclusions was that you could use it to steal digital certificates, which would allow you to make the software that it installed later look like it was a legitimate part of the system. And those things are pretty scary. It could open the door to later attacks.
So in mid-2012, I think it was May, a massive espionage program called Flame was discovered that was able to record nearly everything done on an infected computer, including, even as I understand it, actual real-world conversations going on near it in the room. So that was a new level of, I suppose, espionage or surveillance software, too. What can you tell us about Flame?
Well, it's interesting because when Flame hit the media, it was like it was something new. And as a researcher, we'd known about components of Flame for quite a long time. They'd crop up here and there, and we'd find parts of Flame. What happened is somebody put all these parts together and said, this is Flame. Does that make sense?
Yeah, okay.
So, in other words, we'd seen pieces of it. It wasn't a big surprise to the anti-malware researchers. It was just surprising to see a name given to it and for it to get quite as much airtime as it did. Although I don't blame people for being concerned about Flame. I mean, it can monitor your Skype calls, it tries to download contacts from nearby Bluetooth devices, pulls screenshots, captures audio. It's a pretty impressive, again, surveillance tool. And if you think about the things that you do on your computer and the things that your computer has a microphone, most laptops now have a camera, this piece of malware could leverage a lot of that stuff, which is sort of creepy when you think about it. My laptop goes most places with me. My cell phone goes everywhere with me.
Sure. Well, I mean, there are sites, and there have been for years, online where you can buy spyware and install it in your wife's cell phone and see who she's talking to and that kind of thing. So I gather that this is maybe just a higher level of sophistication of the same kind of thing and is therefore more scary because if it gets into the public domain where you can buy it for, $49.99 on some spyware site, basically everything you do or say is subject to being monitored by anyone. So it
Right. So Flame is it's a pretty high-end piece of malware. It's very big. It's much bigger than the kind of things that you're talking about. But it's exactly the same idea. Yeah.
So now more recently, a new cyber weapon was discovered called Gauss. I guess that the word Gauss is buried somewhere in the code and it refers to a long-dead mathematician maybe or something. But I think it also is believed to be linked by code to the kind of the parent Stuxnet worm, right? And it was found, I gather, to be stealing banking information in the Middle East. So what's up with that one?
Yeah, it's pretty depressing because, you know, as a researcher, we deal with this stuff every day. So Gauss is seeming to go after bank account credentials. Again, I think as a researcher, we see things like this every single day. But Gauss, again, has this really interesting hook. And the interesting hook in Gauss is that it has an encrypted payload that we don't know what it does and we don't know what it's targeting because it's encrypted. The thought is that it may be targeting or designed to target very specific pieces of critical infrastructure, but we simply don't know. The problem with encryption, of course, is until we get the key, and without doing extensive cryptanalysis, it's very difficult to know what that module does. Normally with a computer program, you can just look at it, and if you're sufficiently good and you have sufficient time, you can disassemble it and see what the code does. But in the case of Gauss, whoever wrote Gauss has a piece of code in there that needs a key to be decrypted, and only when you put the right key in will it unlock and you can see what it does.
So who is working on breaking these codes? I mean, if it's such a high-level piece of software, it has to be approached in a high-level way by highly sophisticated people. Is your institute, for example, working on it, or other people in this country trying to break it?
Well, there are a lot of people, a lot of the anti-malware researchers would love to be able to announce that they've broken that piece of code. I know Kaspersky Labs, which is a Russian antivirus company, has been working on it. This isn't the kind of thing we typically do in the institute because these things come and go, and it's very tactical. What we try and do at the institute is look at the underlying causes for these things, and these types of insecurity, and see if we can do something about that. So it's the difference between, you know, responding to something that's immediate and trying to come up with a longer-term solution. Because my personal view is that this is a battle that we're not winning. I don't think it's even winnable. What we have to do is figure out a way to change the rules so that we can make it a better, safer world.
You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with Dr. Richard Ford at the Florida Institute of Technology about cyber warfare and cybersecurity and some of the latest advances, I guess you could call them, or the latest threats coming in the realm of software that can attack computers in a very sophisticated way. So, you know, Richard, the things we've been talking about all appear to be related and to be, on the other hand, so sophisticated that the speculation is that only a government could afford to produce them, that they would take too many people working for too much time, too intensively for, again, that kid in the basement in Romania to do it. But if that's the case, their origin is still unknown, right? So, you know, I speculated at the very beginning that, you know, kind of people thinking the obvious, if it's attacking Iran to start with, that these things were coming from Israel, maybe with the help of the U.S. Can you speculate about that, or what do you think?
Well, I think it is just speculation, although, you know, the kind of smoking gun points increasingly towards the U.S., I think. But in general, you don't make these operations obviously public. So a lot of it is leaks of unclear origin and unclear source and unclear veracity. But I think it's certainly reasonable to say this wasn't written by a 12-year-old kid in their basement. This was a professional group of programmers working very hard. And that kind of talent takes money and it takes a significant effort. And the piece of this puzzle that people don't talk about is what we'd call the ConOps, or concept of operations. And the targeting and the con-ups of this stuff screams nation-state, even more than the software does.
Because a company wouldn't necessarily be worried about trying to break centrifuges in Iran's nuclear processing.
And it's not like Stuxnet has gone out worldwide. It was a very focused, targeted attack. And that implies some physical access, some assets on the ground. It implies a whole bunch of things in the con-ops that tells you it's not just a sort of disgruntled group of hackers doing something. It's a real operation.
So do you mean that it can't be phoned in, but somebody has to bring it in on a thumb drive and stick it in a computer inside that secure facility, that kind of thing?
You have to get somebody to take it in initially, yeah. In many cases, some of these systems were what we call an air-gapped system. An air-gapped system has no physical connection to the outside world. And that's one of the reasons why some of this malware went after thumb drives. But you need to get an infected thumb drive into somebody's hand to achieve that goal. And that part of the operation is non-trivial.
Well, that's scary. I mean, you know, we understand ICBMs or bombers delivering smart weapons or whatever, but in this case you've got a guy on two legs with a job in a facility, maybe a low-level job or whatever, who can walk in with basically a bomb in his pocket and stick it in a computer, and there you go.
That's right. We talk about cyber warfare, but these things blur the line. They run that raggedy edge between the cyber, the online system, and physical systems, and that's one of the reasons why they cause us so much concern.
So, you know, that whole thing then brings up the question, I mean, do you think the Stuxnet code is still secure, or could it have been hacked somewhere and now be used by others, whether it's other nation states or some large corporation or a group of smart kids, or is it secure, and is that security itself secure?
Depends what you mean by code. So the binary code for all these things is out there. Even this morning, somebody sent me a new copy of Gauss, the sort of latest set of modules. As a researcher, you know, it was all encrypted and properly protected, but these things come out all the time. So now I technically have the binary code of that attack, and I could modify it and send it back out if I wished. Of course, I won't. So the binary code of these things is out there, and people can tinker with them and fool with them. The actual source code, to the very best of my knowledge, is not available right now. I haven't seen a copy of the source code. I've seen some attempts to go from the binary object back to the source code, but I don't have any particular concerns about the source code for these things suddenly becoming available. But having the binary code available does mean that people can tamper with them and modify them.
That's what I was going to ask you. I mean, you can't use the binary code to, if you know what you're doing, to get to your own version of a weapon without the source code?
You could. It would be tricky because, again, these things are very big, so if you think about something that's several megabytes in size, there's a lot of ways that it can be modified or have functionality that you don't really understand. So the amount of effort required to do that would be pretty large. So I'm not losing huge amounts of sleep about traditional cyber criminals taking Gauss and modifying it, but not for a good reason, but for a bad reason. They can make their own. They don't have to be so sophisticated, and that way they can morph them and modify them as they see fit because they have all the source code. So it's not that it's too hard. It's just easier to do it other ways.
Yeah, that's encouraging. So there's a hacking group called Anonymous that I think is pretty sophisticated and has a lot of resources. What do you think about them? Are they capable of constructing cyber weapons on their own like this?
It's not Anonymous' style. I like to call Anonymous hacktivists because they have a mission. They're a little bit anarchic in their outlook, but they think they're fighting for something specific. They're hot button of things like internet censorship, the openness of the internet, surveillance, those kind of things. They have broken into some things, or members of Anonymous have certainly broken into some systems by way of protest. But this kind of thing isn't really their style.
So how far have these cyber weapons spread in the U.S.? Does anybody know? I mean, have they been found at all in civilian infrastructure so far? And if so, how many infections have there been, roughly?
The specific things that we've talked about today are not really very focused on the U.S. at all. They were very targeted on the Middle East. With that said, of course, things get around. Some drives get moved from place to place. And I know that there have been reports, for example, of Stuxnet in the U.S.
That's what I thought.
So for sure, that's one of the problems with cyber weapons is they're a little bit hard to aim. Right, so if you have something that replicates, you never really know where it's going to end up. You can control where it goes off, but they get around. But no, these have been pretty targeted attacks, mostly Asia, Middle East, those kind of places.
So what are some of the other, if you want to call it blowback effects, maybe into the civilian world? We mentioned banking systems already, and if banking systems in the Middle East have been hacked, it's, I assume, only a short jump to hack banking systems all around the world. But beyond that, could these weapons, for example, change the mix of ingredients in a product being manufactured? I mean, you know, tinker with what goes into Advil or whatever it might be. And
So most factories are basically electronically controlled. They're run by computer. So the right attack could do all kinds of horrific things to product manufacturer, to the longevity of things, to the content of things, to the power grid. The water system, those things are all vulnerable. The FAA, for example, you know, and the air traffic control system.
Pilot,
that's something that goes through my mind occasionally as I fly around the country.
Sure.
But the good news is that while we know this kind of thing is possible, and while we know that our systems are under attack every day, we haven't really seen anybody pulling that trigger. It is, however, something that as sort of smart, educated, concerned individuals, we should really think about as we design systems and as we think about the amount of money that we want to spend on defending our infrastructure, nobody wants to see very big bills when it comes to infrastructure defense. But there's an awful lot at stake as well right now.
Well, I mean, you know, maybe an analogy is 9/11. Probably somewhere somebody in the government thought that commercial airlines could be hijacked not for kidnapping purposes, but to be used as basically large cruise missiles. I mean, you don't really take it seriously, I guess, until it happens. But, I mean, just imagine if somebody hacked into the defense systems, particularly ballistic missile launch sequence controls, that kind of thing. I mean, good Lord, you know. It could be Armageddon coming in the form of a cyber weapon attack, and you wouldn't really take it seriously until it happened, and then it's too late. So do people worry about that really, really terrible prospect?
The challenge is that it's always harder to be the defender than the attacker.
Yeah.
All I have to do is beat you once to find the attacker, and I won. As a defender, you have to win every single time.
Yeah.
And that's a horrible paradigm. And in fact, again, thinking about those sort of trade-offs and paradigms is something that we do at the Institute. It's something that a game where you only have to lose once to lose the entire game isn't a very good game. We have to think about other ways to shift that.
Well, Richard, we're getting toward the end of the show, so is it likely that government will get in the act with this thing? I mean, you know, I don't know, new performance requirements and standards for industry computer systems, or is there even a prospect of government monitoring of industrial systems? I mean, is it to kind of introduce?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we've already seen a couple of bills that talk about information exchange in this space. There are federal reporting requirements and bills. I think CISPA was probably the most recent bill that has a whole bunch of information pertaining to this kind of thing, where there was a bit of a brouhaha about what could be shared and what couldn't. So we are seeing the laws catch up. Of course, the challenge is technology changes so jolly quickly. So I always remind people that when we first made cars back in England, the first Road Traffic Act was likened, I think it's nicknamed the Red Flag Law, because you had to run along in front of your car with a red flag to warn people it was coming. And that's sort of where we're at with cybercrime laws now. And I'm not certain that the solution to this will be legislative, but I think it'll ultimately be technological.
Richard, we just have maybe in 15 seconds or so, if you can do it, what can a small business owner or just an individual computer user do to, is there anything that they can do other than run the usual virus checker programs to try to slow the possibility of these things?
Absolutely. As well as running a virus checker program, if you're running Windows, there are some very good tools that help you keep your machine patched up to date, a bit like Microsoft Update, but they do all the software on your machine. There's one that's, I think, still free to end users called Secunia, which I use all the time on my machine. I don't hold any stock in the company. I mean, I don't know those guys, but I do love the tool, and it's free for home users, and, you know, it's something they can do to keep their machines a little bit more secure.
Richard, it's been interesting. I wish we could talk a little bit more about this, but we are out of time. Thank you so much for being on with us on American Variety and talking about cybersecurity.
Well, Kurt, thank you very much for having me on. And anytime you want to chat about computers and security, I'd be delighted to do that.
I bet we'll do it again in the future. And thanks to all of you for listening. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.